examine in any detail, were my feelings for him.
You're late.
Morris kept me in the office talking. I'm sorry, Lucas.
Talking about what?
Oh, nothing. Can I see you soon?
You're seeing me now.
I meant...
There's a man I want you to meet. He needs to try and arrange an interview with Harry Hopkins. Officially Secretary of Commerce, actually Roosevelt's right-hand man.
Do you think he'll see me?
No, probably not, but it'll put you in contact with his aide, Mason Harding. He's your target.
Right.
He's susceptible, not happily married. You understand me?
I'm not sure I do.
It's not difficult. We want him compromised, keen to play ball with us. We want you to seduce him so that we can blackmail him. All right.
And tomorrow, revealing more about her life as a spy, Sally talks of the seduction of the American political aide. In Restless, by William Boyd, you heard Eileen Atkins as Sally and Fenella Woolgar as Ruth, with Malcolm Tierney, Matt Addis, Akbar Kurta, Adrian Lucas, Gene Goodman and Jonathan Taffler. It was dramatised by Melissa Murray. The director was Mark Beebe.
The Digital Station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now we continue Matthew Hollis's account of the making of the first World War poet Edward Thomas and his life-changing friendship with the American poet Robert Frost. Tobias Menzies reads, "Now all roads lead to France."
"Zeppelins are coming to London," Edward Thomas wrote to Robert Frost on the 1st of June 1915. The capital had been bombed the night before and was now gripped by the panic buying of gas masks. Everything now was revolving around Thomas's quarrel with himself, whether or not to write poetry, go to America, or enlist. Money was tighter than ever. Even his wife Helen teased him about his prevarication. He wrote to Frost, "These last few days I have been looking at two alternatives, trying to enlist or coming out to America. Helen points out that I could try America and then enlist if it failed, but not the other way around. Frankly, I do not want to go," he confessed, "but hardly a day passes without my thinking I should. With no call, the problem is endless." But the problem was not endless, for a poem of Frost's had arrived which would dramatically force Thomas's hand. "The road not taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveller, long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could, to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay, in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I should be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less travelled by. And that has made all the difference." Noble, charismatic, wise. In the years since its composition, "The Road Not Taken" has been understood by some as an emblem of individual choice and self-reliance, a moral tale in which the traveller takes responsibility for their own destiny. But it was never intended to be read as such by Frost, who was well aware of the playful ironies contained within it. First, he places a mischievous admission about the wearing of the grass. That along each path, the passing there has worn them really about the same. So, when the poem culminates in a claim that he took the path less travelled by, it does so with its tongue in its cheek. But the poem carried a more personal message besides. About a friend who had gone off to war, Frost said later. A person who, whichever road he went, would be sorry he didn't go the other. That person was Edward Thomas. For Thomas, choice was not an act of free will. Instead, some choices are prescribed, compelled, ingrained in circumstance or personality. Some characters are called. He broke the news to Frost. Last week I had screwed myself up to the point of believing I should come out to America and lecture, but I have altered my mind. I am going to enlist, if the doctor will pass me. On the 14th of July, Thomas took his army medical examination. He passed and began the process of letting his friends know. For Eleanor Fargin, he prepared a personal visit, calling at her mother's home. I rose as he came into the room, she wrote. He bent his head, and for the only time in our 4 years of friendship, we kissed spontaneously. He sat down, saying, Well, I've joined up. But to his wife Helen, he broke the news by telegram and left her alone in Steep with her despair. No, 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 was all I could say. Not that. On the morning of the 19th of July, Thomas swore his oath and reported for physical drill at Regent's Park. In September, Thomas made the move out to High Beach Camp near Loughton, Essex, on the fringe of Epping Forest. He described the scene to Jack Haynes. We are in huts, nearly 100 of us in a big corrugated iron room formerly used as Sunday school. Conditions are cramped and not over clean. The food is ill-cooked and ill-served and has to be eaten in haste. A few weeks later, he was asked to report to a new camp called Hare Hall in Romford, Essex. I wonder, would you recognise me with hair cropped close and carrying a thin little swagger cane? He wrote, adding, I was never so well or in so balanced a mood. Whatever the reason for Thomas's mood, there may have been one new factor at play that he was largely concealing. In November, Thomas made a social call on a woman he had not seen in more than 15 years. Edna Clark Hall lived only a few miles from Hare Hall Camp and was a poet and painter. She was a year younger than Thomas, beautiful, and a mother of two. And she was desperately lonely as her husband, a barrister, spent lengthy weeks at his chambers in Gray's Inn. Edna and Edward had first met around the turn of the century, when even then it was apparent to both that her marriage seemed to lack understanding. Thomas used to visit her then in the company of a solicitor friend who would discuss law with William, leaving Edna and Edward to one another's company. They are there, said Edward flirtatiously. And we are here. Over the 8 months he was stationed at Hare Hall Camp, Thomas became a frequent caller. The two would walk together in the fields and lanes surrounding the house, gathering fallen wood from the orchard, with which they would feed the open fire as they talked of their arts of poetry and painting. Thomas's gentle understanding of Edna's domestic plight and their rangy artistic conversations and shared interests were a lifeline to Edna that winter of 1915. Throughout her journals, she captured many of his characteristic, gentle touches. There is a smile at the corner of those lips where pride with tenderness dwell. There is ease in the quiet manner and in the blue of those eyes, like thoughts shy and perfect as a bird. When the call for officers came in that month, Thomas gave it serious consideration. And coming home from Hare Hall that weekend of the 22nd of January, Thomas put to paper a 64-line poem that he had begun to turn over in his head the week before, and which very clearly now pointed towards the next step in his journey. Now all roads lead to France, and heavy is the tread of the living, but the dead, returning, lightly dance. Whatever the road bring to me or take from me, they keep me company with their pattering, crowding the solitude of the loops over the downs, hushing the roar of towns and their brief multitude. As winter deepened, something began to change in the poetry that Edward Thomas was writing. A string of poems mined, or struggled to mine, the subject of love. No one so much as you loves this my clay, or would lament as you its dying day. You know me through and through, though I have not told, and though with what you know you are not bold. None ever was so fair as I thought you. Not a word can I bear spoken against you. All that I ever did for you seemed coarse compared with what I hid, nor put in force. My eyes scarce dare meet you, lest they should prove I but respond to you, and do not love. We look and understand. We cannot speak, except in trifles and words the most weak. Helen found herself questioning the inspiration behind Edward's new poem. Thomas told her that these were verses to his mother, and it is not beyond possibility that they might have begun that way in the mind of the author, although clay had already become a kind of code word that he shared with Edna Clark Hall. He was at pains to tell Helen that he was incapable of loving. "You know my usual belief is that I don't and can't love, and haven't done for something near 20 years. You know, too, that you don't think my nature really compatible with love, being so clear and critical. You know how unlike I am to you, and you know that you love, so how can I?" Whatever the provenance of the winter love poems, the quartet of pieces he wrote that spring were very certainly written for his family. He once referred to them as household poems, one for each of his children, and one for Helen. "I would give you back yourself, and myself too, if I could find where it lay hidden, and it proved kind." On Easter Sunday, from his hut at Hare Hall, Thomas drafted an identical pair of 12-line lyrics, each of which hinted at the passing of opportunity. "Like the touch of rain she was on a man's flesh and hair and eyes, when the joy of walking thus has taken him by surprise. With the love of the storm he burns, he sings, he laughs, well I know how, but forgets when he returns, as I shall not forget her go now." There for a moment the ink of the first draft ended, until Thomas returned later to add in pencil, "Those two words shut a door between me and the blessed rain that was never shut before and will not open again." In only two of Thomas's 142 collected poems do people kiss, here and in The Unknown, written 3 months apart, both in Essex, with Helen away and Edna close by. It is reasonable to suppose both poems are fantasies, projections of ideals and desires. There is little in Edna's journals to expressly suggest that a kiss might have taken place. So intensely does she linger over the minute detail of their glances and touches that an event as noteworthy as this would probably have been written up more than once. The months in Essex have produced 8 or 9 intimate poems. But whoever or whatever had been in his thoughts, these musings would now cease, and his thoughts would turn towards the war.
Tomorrow, Edward leaves for the front in the final episode of Now All Roads Lead to France by Matthew Hollis. The reader was Tobias Menzies. It was abridged by Richard Hamilton and produced by Emma Harding.
Are you sitting comfortably? Well, then we'll begin.
BBC Radio Young Writers, 25 years on.
Shh, now don't tell anyone I've given you special treatment. What a stupid thing to say. Don't tell anyone.
The world was full of beautiful things. Beautiful things surrounding sight and vision.
A look back at the first plays from writers who went on to make their mark in theatre, film and television, and catching up with where they are now.
A powerful play can cause ripples and it can be life-changing and life-saving.
Beginning with Benjamin Zephaniah's Hurricane Dub, Saturday afternoon at 1:15 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock and time for drama. Find out what happens when an American tycoon buys an exclusive hotel on a whim and gets more than he bargained for in a moment. Later, a racy comedy by Gary Brown, which takes a sideways look at the creation of Eric Gill's sculpture of Prospero and Ariel here at Broadcasting House in London. Prospero, Ariel, Wreath and Gill is our play this evening at 9:15. So first here on 4 Extra, one of Arnold Bennett's earliest works. The award-winning writer Chris Harold has written a colourful two-part adaptation of Bennett's society murder mystery, The Grand Babylon Hotel. This is part one.
Here they come. Every morning, same time.
Every morning, same time, like everything else.
Sir, for you, from the purser's office.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Ha! Morgan's up 2 points. That will not last. You take note, Nella.
Papa, what do you expect to have telegrams from your office delivered to you when you were in heaven?
Item, Mr. E.H. Harriman. Now, what's he up to?
Papa!
Contain yourself. You sound like your mother.
Mr. E.H. Harriman, Papa, is doing what Mr. E.H. Harriman always does. Laying down even more railroad to rival the lengths of railroad laid down by Mr. Theodore Wraxall, would be my guess. Taking advantage of you while you're in the middle of the Atlantic. Put down your telegrams. Breathe in the ozone. We're on holiday.
Holiday, yes. I knew something was making me restless. What are you reading?
I thought it would be a romance, but it turned out otherwise.
Tell me.
I was expecting a... mysterious strangers, feuds lasting centuries, love that crosses all boundaries. But the most exciting event so far is the introduction of the Tuppenny Tube.
The author?
A gentleman called Fritz Baedeker.
Let me look. Baedeker's Great Britain. You tease me, Nella. Though the Tuppenny Tube. How I wish I'd thought of that. If Great Britain isn't exciting enough... Would you like to hop across to Paris when we disembark?
Not Paris.
I thought you liked Paris.
No, not Paris.
Whatever you choose, then, I'll give you whatever you choose.
Oh, Father.
The trouble is, sometimes you give me every choice in the world.
I don't want another choice.
No choosing, then. Let fate choose. Close your eyes, Nella. Put your Baedeker on its spine. Let it fall open where it will. A map with a river. With a great loop in it. Now, keep your eyes closed. Let your right hand drop towards the pages, index finger out. Slowly, down it comes. Piccadilly, the Strand. Well, well.
Mind your backs, please, ladies and gents. The luggage going through. This way, sir, madam.
Wake up, Nella. Wake up, my dear. We're here. The Grand Babylon Hotel.
It doesn't look so much.
Ah, you're right, of course. Nowhere could be more
unassuming. Not a word that even explains it's a hotel. And a hotel so discreet that you never ask for a tariff. And money is never discussed.
Is it expensive?
It is expensive, in the way the Atlantic Ocean is deep.
Is it exclusive?
Now see that side street running along the north side of the hotel?
Yes.
You see that black door? That's the east entrance for royalty. Only for royalty. It is in use every day.
I like that. Royalty. Like us.
In our own country, my dear, perhaps. Over here, we will use the plain mahogany doors. Nella, what is it?
Surely I know that man. Perhaps I was mistaken.
Make an entrance with me, if you please, Nella.